miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 7 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned in to The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have an episode of the Disability History Association's podcast on HIV/AIDS, masculinity, and disability. All that right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is ongoing throughout Quebec. The combined effect of two doses ensures better efficacy of the vaccine, reducing the risk of getting and transmitting the virus. You'll also stay protected for a longer period of time. Coming to your appointment for the second dose of the vaccine is a must, whatever else is on your schedule. The second dose of vaccine is essential. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up now is episode 29 of the Disability History Association's podcast. This episode is entitled HIV/AIDS, Masculinity, and Disability. That's up now.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Disability History Association podcast. I'm Kelsey Henry.
And I'm Caroline Leifers.
And today, it's our pleasure to speak with Nicholas Herenik, who joins us from the Department of Historical Studies at the University of Toronto, Mississauga. Nick is a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council postdoctoral fellow who specializes in women, gender, and sexuality studies, with research interests in disability and CRIP studies, queer studies, feminist STS, philosophy, sociology, history, all that good stuff. Nick, we really look forward to chatting with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So I had the pleasure of happening across your work when I was wearing one of my other professional hats, as the editorial assistant for Disability Studies Quarterly, or DSQ. And I copy edited your article, No Sorrow, No Pity, Intersections of Disability, HIV/AIDS, and Gay Male Masculinity in the 1980s for DSQ's forthcoming June 2021 issue. And as soon as I read it, I was like, we have to get Nick on the podcast. One of my favorite questions to ask folks, just to start, is when you realized that disability studies was relevant to your work, or that you were already doing disability history in one way or another, but maybe you weren't calling it that initially, or you didn't realize that's what you were doing initially. Was your path to disability studies chosen? Did you know that you wanted to go in that direction, or did the field sort of find you in an unexpected way?
So thank you for that question. It's a really good question. And it actually was unexpected, my arrival in disability studies. It was a pleasant, surprising arrival. Most recently, I would say, disability studies began to really show itself in the final chapter of what was my dissertation, but is now a forthcoming book I have. It's under contract right now with University of Toronto Press. And I was interested, of course, with gay male masculinity as I focus on it throughout the book. But the last chapter, because I end in 1987 for various reasons, mainly because the source I'm using as the premise ends in 1987, it was important to, I felt, the last chapter deal with HIV and AIDS. But one of the things that stood out to me the most was the way in which the discussions around gay masculinity and gay male bodies used the language, particularly those that were debilitated by AIDS, and I say that purposefully, because they use the language of disability. And so I began to unravel this and say, this is more than semantics. It's more than simply, you know, a peculiar word choice, but rather it resonates for the ways in which we understand bodies and the way that bodies move through time and space. And it made me start questioning the ableism in other aspects of my work. And so it was a really, really organic evolution, I would argue. But then I look back on older research I have done. So I have an article that came out in 2015 on what was called the Peacock Revolution. And this was just sort of a brief fashion movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s, inspired by Hugh Hefner and the bachelor phenomenon of, like, where they could wear cravats and gold suits and, you know, smoking jackets and you know, think of Austin Powers in some way. There's a flamboyancy. But I thought, this is really interesting because this is a time period. Think about it, it's the late 60s, early 70s. Gay liberation is starting to take hold. Gay visibility is growing exponentially as a result. And what we're seeing is straight men acting very flamboyantly, cosmopolitan or metropolitan. And gay men, in fact, are acting in some ways more butch. So I'm like, whoa, 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 what's going on here? They're almost speaking to each other without speaking to each other. And I saw ads that would talk about how the designer for clothing, like, you know, it would bring up like Dior or someone, whoever's marketing certain products. And they would bring up the sexuality of the designer, saying, you know, they're not just another mad gay designer. Like, and that's quite a literal quote that was in one of the ads. And, but to reassure men who bought those clothes to say, but you're not gonna have your sexuality or masculinity questioned for being interested in fashion. So just because they are, doesn't mean you aren't. And so I began to think about where the primacy of the body was in that respect, and the way in which bodies are framed and contorted in advertisements, and to think about how we understand and we read bodies. So I've always been interested in the body, and that's when I began to see these broader questions of ability and the way we also see bodily failure. And then that's what led me right to disability studies. And then the beautiful thing about disability studies, of course, is that it flips it on its head, and it makes me think about bodily failure in almost complete reversed terms, and start thinking about ability as something of a failure of consciousness or something that is so ubiquitously powerful because it's invisible, right? Which is often what disability studies does, is to highlight the invisibility, what we don't want to see, right? So so it was a very organic movement, definitely out of my dissertation and my first book, but it's actually coming to shape my second book, which I'm happy to talk about at later on.
Thank you so much, Nick. And yeah, we'll be asking you about both your first and second book actually shortly. So very much looking forward to that. The article that you shared with us that we'll be talking largely about today provides a textual analysis of the body politic. So can you tell us about why you chose the body politic as your primary text? How did you get into this? Why did it seem like the right place to put your focus?
Yes, thank you. So The Body Politic was published between 1971 and 1987. And it, between those years, it was the largest gay and lesbian newspaper in Canada, but it also had a prominent international readership as well, spanning to Western Europe, to South America, and so on. And you see that with a lot of readers writing into the newspaper, talking about various issues, topics at hand. A lot of archival material comes from it as well, so it's quite a rich textual source. There were a lot of images published in The Body Politic because part of their mantra in establishing a newspaper was that visualizing sexuality was part and parcel of sexual liberation, right? So that they needed to visualize the body and visualize same-sex love and desire. So the politicking that was going on in The Body Politic was quite large. And the editorial collective who had started The Body Politic came out of the We Demand protests of 1971 on Parliament Hill, in which, early gay liberationists set out a series of demands, if you will, to end the systematic oppression of gays and lesbians in the country, particularly because up until 1969, homosexuality was criminalized, and it was only in 1969 that it was partially decriminalized in Canada. So I chose The Body Politic, of course, because of its wide scope, and these were not small issues. I think the first issue was up to about 30 some odd pages, and you know, within the next year or two, by at least by the mid 70s, they were like 50 page issues. So like it was more, if anything, in line with a special interest magazine than a newspaper. But you know, it had such rich context and content. But I want to add that it was an English paper, and that it didn't feature much French content. It would cover issues going on in Montreal, or you know, something that might have happened in France, but it was more than anything an English newspaper. So there is that caveat. But I want to also just finally say that by looking at The Body Politic, and when I was exploring this relationship, particularly in the context of the article around this relationship between HIV and AIDS with disability, that I'm not trying to fill a gap here. Rather, I'm turning my attention to the ways in which disabilities always existed and been there, just simply unspoken, unrecognized, and unacknowledged. So I don't see myself as highlighting or addressing a gap, but rather reformulating a truth.
Yeah, that's so beautifully put. And I think we'll tie in really nicely with an upcoming question about historiography. I love that. So we'd love to hear a little bit more about the way that you were analytically just working with The Body Politic, or TBP for short. Your analysis covers both the discussions of disability in TBP that predated the onset of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the early 80s, and the discussions of disease-induced disability or debilitation that were caused by HIV in subsequent years. And I'm wondering, how did that earlier conversation around disability in gay male sexuality make its way into later conversations about frailty and undesirability in response to embodiment and HIV/AIDS.
Yes. So you're right to say that there were earlier conversations around disability pre-HIV/AIDS epidemic. But they were far and few between. So in 1980, Gerald Hannon of The Body Politic comes out with this article called No Sorrow, No Pity, which is now eponymously the name of my article. And in it speaks about the marginalization of people with disabilities in the gay and lesbian community, particularly in Toronto. And Hannon has a wide set of conclusions about what has contributed to the systematic marginalization or, you know, invisibility, if you will, of persons with a disability. But what I appreciated was that he also interviewed those with a disability to ask them about their experiences. So I remember there was an individual by the name of Richard, and Richard actually spoke about what it was like to navigate the queer community as somebody who was blind. Interestingly enough, though, Richard also published a classified ad in the following months in the back of The Body Politic. And the classified section was a place where men could meet other men, and women as well. But it was obviously like a lot of gay liberation, unfortunately, at the time was extremely male-centric. So it was like Grindr of the 1980s and 70s, right? So this is how they were meeting each other. And but one of the things that Richard had said, and I thought this was fascinating, explained himself and said, you can actually see a profile of myself in earlier issues, and defined himself, but then also said, please send a photo if possible, and also gave a description of what he was looking for. And I thought it was very interesting that Richard, as a self-described blind man, was also asking us for a photo to then, whether that was to have it like legibly described to him, or he himself, you know, based on disability is a spectrum, that he himself could still utilize that photo in imagining his ideal partner, or if this person was a match. I thought it was extremely interesting and shows the way in which they navigated the queer community in their own ways. So it was really important to understand how these discussions laid the foundation for then what would become discussions around disability that and that were all disabled. So Hannon gives this article, No Sorrow, No Pity. And in the latter part, he makes us reconceptualize disability and able-bodiedness. And this is mind-blowing from the 1980s. Because he's thinking about disability as something that we all oscillate in and out of. So he speaks about when you're a baby and you rely on your parents for everything, to be fed, to be clean, to be warm, and says that as a a tiny, tiny little human being, you rely, you need that support because you are essentially unable to care for yourself. And then also speaks about the fact that when you get to a certain point in age, when you're so old, you may need that similar type of care. And so what he says is that we're all disabled at one point or another, and we need to all think about disability in that way. And so I was like, this is really interesting, also very thought-provoking for the 1980s to be thinking about ability and able-bodiedness in this way. So these kind of conversations were about highlighting disability. They were talking about processes, or I should say practices of discrimination that were faced, that were facing people with disabilities. There was an article that was published a couple issues after called Stair Trek. And in it, they spoke about how almost all gay bars in Toronto had stairs to get into, whether they were above a shop or below in a basement. And as a result, that was a physical barrier that inhibited certain people from coming to these venues, right? Particularly people with physical disabilities. But what was more heartbreaking, but also interesting to see, was the way in which people with cognitive disabilities were ridiculed and mocked out of these spaces. So one of the gentlemen, unfortunately, I can't remember their name, but they were also interviewed in Hannon's article. And one of the gentlemen spoke about how, as a person with cerebral palsy, they went to one of the bars and somebody actually said, like, do you expect to pick up here? Like, what are you doing here? And so there was a policing of space. And like, I think it's extremely important to remind ourselves that one of the reasons why people with disabilities were marginalized or made to be invisible in the queer community was not simply because of formal institutions like institutionalization and practices, but informal practices like bullying and hazing and so on. So these conversations are happening before HIV/AIDS. And another thing that's going on as well is we're beginning to see the formative years of disability activism in the queer community. So in 1977, Raymond Barton, who was about 27 at the time, goes to San Francisco and finds something completely revolutionary, which was those who were deaf, queer deaf people, meeting other queer deaf people and establishing some sort of community that existed well beyond the bars, which were, of course, a huge meeting place for many liberationists and gays and lesbians in the 1970s and 80s. So he brings that back to Toronto with him on his adventure to San Francisco, and he forms the York Rainbow Society of the Deaf. And they go to the Parkside Tavern, which is a bar in Toronto, and they sign, and this is actually documented by Hannon. And he talks about how there is a queer, gay, deaf, whatever they want to describe themselves as, because the terms always change, but they were a gay, deaf group who, you know, co-opted or, you know, forced themselves to be in spaces that were never acknowledged to have catered to them. You know, the Parkside Tavern is often remembered as a space of gay male camaraderie and cruising and all that, but it's never remembered as a space which also housed the York Rainbow Society of the Deaf, that they were there signing and, you know, engaging in disability activism. So I think that's extremely important. So these earlier efforts to at least even bring disability into the minds of readers of the body politic, of course, then shape later conversations around HIV/AIDS. So these earlier questions about what it meant to be disabled, what it meant to be desirable and have a disability, and we also see that with other readers like Warren Camp of Mississauga, who writes in and speaks about having two prosthetic legs but not in need of a wheelchair, and spoke about how that made his coming out easier by going to the bars. He could still go to the bars. So what we realized then is participation was a fundamental aspect in sort of helping gays and lesbians with disabilities, you know, come to that sexual awakening or sexual realization. They had to be able to participate, if you will, in this burgeoning culture. And one of the ways they did that, of course, was whether it was co-opting spaces or finding themselves in certain places, was by, you know, grassroots activism. And this would shape similar processes around HIV/AIDS in the subsequent years. So by 81, we begin to see, the first signs of AIDS rear its head. You know, I believe it was the San Francisco newspaper that talked about five gay men, or is it a number of gay men, were showing up with Kaposi sarcoma, which is a rare type of melanoma. And of course, we know that is indicative of late stage AIDS. And the conversations, of course, that take place by the time HIV/AIDS is known, it's not just mythologized. Some people believed in 81 that it was a remnant, or it was a result of the right wing, sort of Christian majority saying, you know, this is just a way of demonizing homosexuality. But it fundamentally changes what it means to be able-bodied, and it brings sexual practices into question. It brings the concept and questions of desire into focus, something that has been, of course, being wrestled with now for years within the gay disability community, as we saw with Raymond Barton and others. But it's now all of a sudden, it's on the agenda of everybody rather than just a small segment, right? So AIDS expands the scope, I should say, of disability activism in a way.
I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit more about how exactly the the aesthetics of disability or the language, like representation around disability, was constructed as somehow antithetical to gay male masculinity in TBP. And I have so many other thoughts here about how like disability is often associated with asexuality or like a desexualization. But what's so curious about HIV-induced debilitation is that that's connected to hypersexuality or perceptions of hypersexuality and promiscuity. So yeah. There's a lot going on there. And I'm wondering like more specifically, how were disease and disability considered to be at odds with queer embodiment? So stylization. Wow, I can't say this word today. Stylizations of the body as virile, healthy, hypermasculine. And then the second part of that question, I know you mentioned you were talking about the criminalization of homosexuality, but homosexuality has also been medicalized as a disease category or a mental illness. And I'm wondering what role the medicalization of homosexuality played in shaping hostility towards disease and disability in gay male communities. So two questions there. Disease and disability at odds with queer stylizations of the body. And what does this have to do with the pathologization of homosexuality?
Yes, and thank you. So first and foremost, when it comes to the stylization of the body, we should understand that gay male masculinity and masculinities, I mean, because it is a spectrum and there were various types of performances, but over the course of the 1970s, and as we see a gay male culture formulate out of early gay liberationist activities, and the body politic, I would argue, became just as much a cultural periodical as it did an engine of political activism. What we see is gay male masculinity begin to take shape, aesthetic shape, along able-bodied white muscular lines. And this is actually what constituted what they called the macho clone. And they said they called them the clone because they were so ubiquitous. Everybody had six packs and like mustaches and wore tank tops that they were just like, oh, they all look alike, right? Like you would mistake people because they'd be like, oh, I thought you were so-and-so. And they're all just clones. And so gay male masculinity is being imagined along these lines. And this is should come as no shock because it still is imagined along muscular, white, able-bodied lines. And now you can argue that many didn't embody macho, but macho was presented in bathhouse advertisements, bar advertisements, even by some members of the body politic as the image of masculinity, as well as the image of gay liberation. Like this is what it means to be gay, is to be beautiful. And you see that because those same images are evocative of pride in the contemporary period, right? That when we think about pride and you think of like Absolut Vodka or anybody else who wants to sell stuff during pride, they typically present a very specific image of gay masculinity. And it is one that embodies these tropes of desirability. So this is not new. That's sort of what inspired me at first to write about gay male masculinity, to say, you know, kids, this isn't new. Pride, the politics of desire and able-bodiedness, that pride is not new. This is something we've been wrestling with since gay liberation, but even well before it. I mean, all gay liberation did was basically say porn, gay porn of the 1920s, well through to the 1960s, is a part of gay male heritage, gay male culture, right? And there are a few scholars who've tried to do that. So you have this particular aesthetic of gay male masculinity being presented as like the epitome of desire. And this, of course, stands inherently at odds with a disabled or diseased body. One of the ways it does is that, as you mentioned in your question, it exemplifies or exudes understandings of the body as virile and healthy, particularly the male body. And these were all correlated with hypermasculinity. And I say it's hypermasculine because I think about Susan Sontag's questions on camp, and it's just so over the top. Like, you know, they're making fun of it, right? And that's what camp is. Like, when you're in on the joke, you get it. You realize the artifice that everything is. And then you realize like, oh, but I can poke fun at it. My issue is, and this is where I sort of, I dance between being post-structuralist on one hand and sort of saying there's no self and everything's an artifice and social construction, but then saying in some ways, I think of like Irving Goffman and dramaturgy and sign vehicles in which saying, but these were also ways in which people began to identify with the community around them. And by saying like, I want to participate in clone culture, or I want to look like that, or I don't look like that, so I feel like I'm failing. Like, this is a politics around the body that come out of having a very narrow image of gay masculinity being presented. So those with a disability, of course, are not going to see themselves represented. And there was this particularly provocative image I saw, and I want to say it was in The Body Politic. Please don't hold me to it, though, but it was in during my archival findings, and it is in it. And it was an image of a wheelchair and no one in it. And I thought nothing could exude the invisibility faced by people with disabilities more than that image of saying, you know, they see the wheelchair, but they don't see the person in it. They don't see the sexuality of the person, the desirability of the person in it. They simply see disability. And I think that evoked to me, you know, the politics of able-bodiedness and disability in an ableist society in which we don't see people for who they are. We see them for what their bodies can perform and how their bodies perform and, you know, the legibility of their masculinity in this context. So healthy, virile, you know, hyper-masculine, all desirable characteristics of the macho clone. But then HIV/AIDS happens. And what that does is it threatens to strip that male body from its virility, of its healthiness, and therefore relegate it to the periphery as bodies that were perceived as disabled had been. And so I think this speaks in some ways to the second question, because the pathologization, as you rightly put, of homosexuality has been inextricably linked. And this has been since the late 19th and early 20th century, some might even say before that. But when with the rise of sexologists, and you have like Sigmund Freud, you have Magnus Hirschfeld and others who are writing about sexuality. You know, of course, they had much more rudimentary terms for homosexuality. But what that did was it didn't, just as much as it classified a group of people who shared same-sex desires, it also meant straight people had an awakening and being like, oh, I know what I am because therefore I know what I'm not. Because like straight people weren't going around in the 18th, 17th century to be like, yeah, I'm a heterosexual. They didn't know what they were. They were just like, oh, I know I'm not engaging in that. So therefore, I must be heterosexual. By the time that we begin to see this medicalized shift, we also know that disability has been pathologized to the high heavens. And I mean, part of when we're engaging crypt theory and we're looking at disability studies, it's to break free of that pathology. And that pathologization, the pathologizing language, if you will. And that's something I was very, I thought about deeply when I was talking about those collisions between disability and disease, because I didn't want to repathologize disability. What I wanted to say was that the diseased body, the HIV/AIDS afflicted body, was pathologized using the language of disability. It, you know, within the same community that attacked the medical profession for pathologizing homosexuality. So it was interesting to see the ways in which pathologization doesn't just happen from the medical field and from those with PhDs and fancy titles, but also happens from the ground up within the community itself. And of course, this undoubtedly shaped understandings of disability as well as desirability. And I think of Robert McCrewer's concept of stigmaphobic distancing, in which members of a community will distance themselves from others in order to be seen as more normal or more desirable. And in this case, what we see is those with unaffected by HIV/AIDS, or even those with it, distance themselves from disability, those without the disease distance themselves from HIV/AIDS because they wanted to be seen as not just healthy and virile or masculine or normal, but as a way of saying that they could be accepted or tolerated in mainstream society, just as queer folks had done with persons with disabilities throughout the 70s. And I don't want to generalize, by the way, and say that everybody did it, but there's a cultural process that's going on, a broader shift to how we appreciate and bodies we don't appreciate, right? As Butler, Judith Butler would say, bodies that matter. Well, what bodies don't matter?
That's really interesting. There's so much there to unpack about the power of apologization as a way of sort of regaining control over a crisis, right? A really scary situation is striking at the heart of newly won freedoms for the gay community in this period, right? Let's talk a little bit more about some of the specific debates that you see showing up in the pages of The Body Politic about these representations of disability and disease that reinforce the quote undesirability of the AIDS body while simultaneously addressing stigmas of the disease. Can you give us some more detail there?
Absolutely. So some of the earlier debates and questions around disability per se were first and foremost brought forth by persons with disabilities, by gay men or women with disabilities, saying, I'm here, I'm in the community, you need to recognize me, you need to realize that I am just as much a member of this community as you are. So it was a lot of activist work, what the big word is now, a form of collective care, if you will. And of course, this fundamentally changes with HIV/AIDS, but we see this correlation, this collision of this language in recounts of the ravaging effects the disease has on particularly gay men. So Gerald Hannon, the same individual editorial member who wrote No Sorrow, No Pity, talking about disability, also spoke about a time in which he went to New York City to visit his friend, Fred. And it was his visit with Fred, who I believe was a pseudonym for a man named Larry, but that aside, it was his visit with Fred in which he began to see the ravaging effects of HIV/AIDS. So what he noticed was Fred was struggling with Kaposi sarcoma. He had cancer and he was going through chemo and whatnot. And he actually spoke about when Fred lost his mustache, he lost a great sense of pride. So he actually spoke about how Fred identified through his mustache, which I thought was interesting, that facial hair became a signifier of masculinity. But when he came back after, he made a couple trips, but I think it was his second or third trip that he spoke about Fred looking rather gaunt and almost like a husk, right? Like debilitated and frail, and just his body was failing and he looked weak. But it was that experience too, in which he noted like Fred's friends stopped coming around. They wouldn't come to visit. And, you know, some people were scared of contracting the disease by just simply, you know, going into someone's apartment who had HIV/AIDS. I mean, there were still a lot of questions about transmission. So we see the collision, particularly in the ways in which people with HIV/AIDS are described. Brian Texier, I might be butchering the last name, but one writer for The Body Politic spoke about people with AIDS as lepers to be denied. He described them as lepers. And I thought this was extremely interesting because in many ways, those were almost the exact same words that a few people with disabilities writing in even just a year prior had described themselves. They're like, I feel like a leper in my own community that I'm pushed aside. So I thought, this is really interesting that the same type of language is being used. And when it is used, it's almost exclusively to talk about disease and talk about oppression, but we never talk about, they never really gave room for people with disabilities to speak about the opportunities their disability, that they still had despite disabilities, or, you know, the way in which we need to re-envision the world around them. I mean, you have Hannon writing in 1980, but it was still an able-bodied publication, one centered on able-bodied gay male culture. So I think you're seeing those instances of collision really happen when an HIV/AIDS body is described, or there's a film review, for example, the film Buddies that came out, and I want to say it was 1984 or 5, forgive me for the specific date, but when it came out, you see there was a film still that was published in The Body Politic from the movie. And it's just this sullen looking white man with what is clearly a spot of Kaposi sarcoma on his face, a lesion. And he's looking sullenly into the camera, and there's someone sort of blurred a little bit, like out of focus, behind him sitting there. And the immediate reaction you get when you see that image is he's alone, he's isolated, he's depressed, there's trauma. And these are all types of ways in which they aestheticize the AIDS-afflicted body. This was also done in mainstream periodicals as well, like Time magazine, when Rock Hudson came out, and that was news to the world. Rock Hudson disclosed his HIV status, and they showed contrasting images. And there was one image of a healthy, young, heterosexual, in quotes, Rock Hudson, who was virile and square-jawed and the epitome of red-blooded American masculinity. And then there was the homosexual Rock Hudson, who was frail, weak, debilitated, gaunt, everything you can imagine. And it was said, like, homosexual Rock Hudson, and it's like, has AIDS. Like, you know what I mean? The idea is like, okay, so what happens when you lose that sanitized image of straight masculinity? You have gay masculinity, which is, of course, diseased or debilitated. So I see a lot of instances in which, particularly with the AIDS crisis unfolding, gay men distancing themselves from those with it in order to secure their own desirability and their own sexuality in a way. And it's one of the reasons why you also see a lot of bodybuilding and gym culture take off, because there was this idea that if I could have muscles and I have a healthy looking body, then no one would mistake me for having AIDS because I don't look gaunt. I don't look like that. So there was a politics of aesthetics wrapped up in this whole larger concern around sexuality and desirability.
I don't know if this is so much a question. It's more just a comment. What you were saying was really making me think about the ways that the HIV/AIDS afflicted body became kind of a stigmata of homosexuality. And yes. I'm thinking about kind of the far right, like conservative responses to HIV/AIDS as the wrath of God, and kind of the epidermalization of gay sin. So there was, it's interesting to think about the interplay there between kind of how the conservative media was interpreting the HIV/AIDS afflicted body as evidence of internal behavioral pathology in homosexuality, and the response, like the countercultural response within gay male communities in terms of bodybuilding, how just culturally freighted or loaded that was, like the need to disavow the HIV/AIDS afflicted body because of the way that it was being stylized as like proof of gay pathology, like needing to construct a better, healthier, like reformed image.
Absolutely. And I couldn't have said it better myself. And I think what we see, so it's a combination of forces with bodybuilding per se, but absolutely it takes on new meaning away from self-defense or desirability strictly. And it is a way in which, again, to draw McCrura's stigmaphobic distancing back in again, a way in which those who at least appeared or identified as healthy and didn't think anything was wrong with their bodies, a way for them to feel like they could still participate in this gay male culture. And it does also speak to larger concerns going on around the wrath of the far right and this idea that, you know, this was divinely ordained, that this was a God-given punishment. You have the far Christian majority with like Anita Bryant and the moral majority, if you will, who spoke out against homosexuality. And that's why I think there was such hesitancy at first to believe that AIDS was even a thing, because they thought this was a lot of, you know, myth-making and scare tactics, fear-mongering among those, that Christian sect, who believed homosexuality to be a sin. And this was very much a response to the Christian right, but they also felt that Christianity and sort of this moral conservatism was a bedfellow to medicalization. And so they felt that there was this innocent, many were, so when I'm seeing these early discussion on HIV and AIDS, I'm seeing not just a critique or concern that this might be the work of the right wing of social conservatives, but that this was also the work of pathologists who have long felt that homosexuality, like if we could just find that gay gene, if we can just find out what makes you tick, that this was the work of a medicalized industry that has long sought to regulate gay bodies, bodies beyond the normal. And I think that's where we also see another form of overlapping with those with a disability, because disabled bodies have been pathologized to the high heavens. And again, if they weren't being medically scrutinized, they were being regulated. And by regulated, I mean putting in institutions, sequestered from the rest of society, right? Because that they should not, you look at Susan Schweck's ugly laws. There was an aesthetic. Some people could be so ugly, quote unquote, they could not be fit for public life. And they were actually told, like, stay in your home or go into an institution because they had deformities or disabilities that were just seen as, quote unquote, obscene. And we, like, you know, and we would never allow that to happen in this day and age. But in some ways, the HIV/AIDS body was treated the same way. Like, it was so grotesque in a way that it had to die alone in an apartment, you know, away from loved ones or family, because people were scared of contracting it. And that's not to generalize, say, all bodies. And I also don't want to perpetuate the idea that gay men were somehow uncaring or unsupportive, because there was a lot of love. There was a lot of love and there was a lot of trauma. But I think you would be remiss to not acknowledge, as you said, that there were reverberations with working out with the gay male body as a site, as a response to questions about bodily failure.
I'm really curious about this because I'm recalling that book. I think it's from about 1983. It's called How to Have Sex in an Epidemic. And it's a book about safe sex, right? But I'm wondering about the safe sex discourse and how that came to be part of this, if at all. Was this a way of sort of preserving the capacity of the diseased body to be sexual? Is this about trying to, I don't know, walk that fine line, right, between suggesting that there is risk, but it is manageable? I mean, I would really love to hear your thoughts on safe sex, which in many cases actually emerged from within the gay community, right, how that played into the conversation.
Yes, thank you. So, well, you're absolutely right to say that it emerged in the gay community in response to the AIDS epidemic. I mean, before, of course, you had bathhouses and bars galore, and bathhouse culture and promiscuity, I don't want to say was for everybody, but promiscuity was definitely a common practice in, or a common behavior or idea in the gay male community as a response to what they saw as heteronormative monogamy. They saw it as a way of a big F you, if you will, to straight society's moral restrictions. And this also bled into things like they were anti-marriage, which, funny enough, with AIDS also affects gay marriage in a way, and I'll get to that in a second. But so AIDS completely flips this on its head. And you begin to see a lot of vocal proponents within the gay liberation movement and queer activism of the 1980s say, like, okay, safe sex is needed because we're starting to understand that, you know, AIDS can be, HIV can be transmitted through sexual intercourse. There are certain behaviors that are more risky than others. And at one point, I think it was 1984, the AIDS Act, which is the AIDS Committee of Toronto, they published an ad in which showed a very white, muscular body, headless. And it said 1 in 4 may have been exposed to the HIV AIDS virus. I think they just called it the AIDS virus at the time. But this idea was that that was the body that was having all of the sex. Therefore, that was the body that was at risk. And this subsequently, and it's not a way of demonizing any efforts, but what this did was it also imagined AIDS as a white man's disease, ignoring the ravaging effects that AIDS has had on racialized communities. Essex Hemphill and a few other artists and authors have described this lack of acknowledgement of the disease's effects on particularly Black communities. Which have been disproportionately affected by HIV/AIDS. And it actually says that this is actually a legacy of slavery in which Black suffering is considered, quote unquote, unremarkable. So it's, we've just become accustomed to Black suffering. So therefore, what's the point of talking about it with HIV and AIDS? And so in Toronto, so you have these efforts to visualize the AIDS body. And it, as you said, it walks this fine line between encouraging people to be able to still engage with practices and behaviors that had long been standard in gay male sexuality, which was like cruising or going to the bathhouses, at the same time addressing a very real epidemic that was costing lives. And for many, they didn't necessarily want to give up their sexual practices. And so safe sex was a I think, the best compromise they could think of. Was through condom use. But I think it was about 83, 84 when everybody really started taking it seriously and saying, okay, something needs to change. And interestingly enough, out of that, we begin to see this huge push for monogamy within some segments of the gay male community, which of course, and then in turn, in addition to things like pension benefits and other employment relationship recognition, if you will, leads to gay marriage, which was antithetical to the earliest principles of gay liberation. So in some ways, AIDS actually, and its push for monogamy, encourages this movement for gay marriage, because to say like, you know, we're just like everybody else, right? And there's a certain homo nationalism wrapped up in that. So, you know, I think, yeah, AIDS completely changes the conversation. And to go around just quickly back to disability, I think it does spark some benefits. It makes a lot more people sympathetic to the rights and needs of people with disabilities, right? As people become debilitated by HIV or AIDS, or they begin to feel similar processes of isolation or ostracism, they sympathize, right? And it's sad that it takes something like that for someone to then feel empathetic towards another group. At the same time, it also fosters a type of apprehension around the body in which you want to further separate yourself from the disabled body by saying like, yeah, okay, but this is, or even the HIV AIDS body, afflicted body, because to say like, look at, and again, that goes back to the questions around and discussions around bodybuilding, right? What meaning does the muscular body now have? Well, it says to a lot of people, wow, they're healthy looking. So they must be a great source for sex. And just to elaborate just for a second, I think that, they promoted safe sex to prevent transmission, not to reclaim sexuality for those who had already been affected. And I think that's fundamentally different, because those who had HIV/AIDS had a very small platform. They would describe the oppressions they faced or the experiences of the stigmatization of their Kaposi sarcoma, or if they'd get odd looks, or being isolated in a hospital ward, right? Treated with hazmat suits. They would describe those horrifying instances. But they were used as, I think in some ways, it was almost an illustrative facet of the ravaging effects of the disease, rather than giving them a place to say, like, I'm still a source of desirability. Like, I can still make a great partner. I can still, you know, those were not the kind of conversations they were having. The kind of conversations they were having is, let's stop the spread. Let's make sure more people don't get it. And safe sex was one of the big reasons. So I don't want to make it sound like, people with HIV/AIDS were given a platform in which they could say, like, I can still have sex, because I think for them, it almost might have counter-argued against safe sex, right? Than to say, like, okay, so, you know, but it's messy. And as someone who also was not alive at the time, I'm doing my best to sort through the archival material as sensitively as possible, because unfortunately, a lot of people who were are not with us anymore. And so we have to take that into consideration as well.
That's super important. Thank you so much, Nick. And it reminds me of that scene from And the Band Played On, where they're talking about Gitanjuga, and there's that, it's meant to seem grotesque, this idea of Gitanjuga like having sex, and then something about him looking down and seeing his Kaposi sarcoma on his body, and then saying something to the effect of, maybe you'll have this too.
Exactly. And I only say that as well, because I had done interviews with community members at the time, and one of which who helped work with Black Cap, which is the Black Coalition Against AIDS for AIDS Prevention, I'm sorry, in Toronto, spoke about a racial discomfort, if you will, among some about African Canadians coming in with HIV diagnoses. And there's a sort of like, oh, we just didn't expect to see you here. And it's like, okay, so then that's why Black Cap formed, right? I mean, not to say that people were racist at ACT or any other age, but there were certain needs that obviously needed to be met within racialized communities around the disease, right? And so, as I'd mentioned before, they were not being discussed. AIDS was still being imagined as a white man's disease, right? Because white men were having all the sex, apparently, quote unquote. So therefore, they were the ones at highest risk.
Thank you so much for that. I want to pivot back to your article a little bit and talk more about a distinction that you make, but acknowledge that is complicated, and that is between disability and disease. And I'm curious about whether that distinction was important for your historical actors in the 1980s, and if it was important for you analytically. Can you talk us through some of that?
Absolutely. So again, I wanted to make sure I did not repathologize disability. And I also did not want to re-medicalize, in many ways, the gay male body. What did I wanted to show, of course, was that the language of disability was used to describe the effects of the disease, but also that we're now seeing, as a result of the disease, a politicking of bodies that matter and bodies that no longer mattered, if you will. Because, well, they didn't matter in terms of sex. They mattered in other ways, but they didn't matter in terms of sex. And for some, AIDS may have been what made a body fail or no longer sexually viable. So this relegated them, in some cases, to an invisible periphery. And I'm thinking of, you know, the numerous instances which are described around being alone or isolated in an apartment or in hospice or in the hotel, the hospital room, if you will, the ward. And this is similar to the formal institutionalization which relegated those with disabilities out of sight. And
there is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are just listening to an episode of the Disability History Association's podcast. To continue listening to this episode, you can check out dishist.org. That's dishist.org. And that completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to produce news produced by and for the Montreal community, contact The Avalanche at avalanchekut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Herse. That's up next.
right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
Hey, you. Come over here and listen.
Oh, God, I'm so fucking wet. Yeah. Yeah.
It's time for Audio Smut.
Nous sommes le 7 juillet 2021, il est 6h du soir, et vous écoutez Audio Smut sur les ondes de CKUT 90.3 FM. Je m'appelle Mycelium, et aujourd'hui j'ai le plaisir de recevoir comme artiste invité Charles Voyer. Charles Voyer est un artiste de théâtre formé au Conservatoire d'art dramatique de Montréal en 2018 et en mise en scène lors d'un stage à la Schaubühne à Berlin, avec Das Fraulein, compagnie d'Anne-Cécile van Dalem, pour sa création Die Anderen en 2019. En janvier 2020, travaillant en étroite collaboration avec des artistes en art visuel, en composition musicale et en performance, Quartet Solo, d'après Müller, vit le jour dans la salle intime du Théâtre Prospero. Dans ce solo interdisciplinaire qu'il a mis en scène, interprété et partiellement écrit, il s'est investi comme dans un cérémonial en refusant de feindre la réalité. Règle générale, il cherche une dramaturgie de l'intime où se mêlent récits personnels et performances. Il s'applique à éveiller la sensibilité de l'autre, à confronter les réalités et à chercher, par l'incarnation de la douleur, une forme de sublimation. Cet été, Audio Smut vous propose un programme spécial à thème Debussy